Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist mom, Diane Lim. We will be discussing generational perspectives and the role of economists in policymaking. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for a CQ roll call is reporting that senior appropriators cleared a major roadblock for passing long-delayed spending bills, reaching a deal on a bipartisan blueprint for carving up about $1.37 trillion in discretionary spending among the dozen overdue bills needed for the fiscal year that is already 2 months old. A stopgap funding measure was also recently passed that extends current funding levels for all federal agencies to December 20th, moving that deadline from November, which originally would have been October 1st. This new plan apparently remedies disputes over funding priorities that have crippled the process to date, and it sidesteps such issues as border wall funding. The White House has said it needs to see the details of the funding plan before responding to it. Even with the new plan for appropriations bills, the new deadline of December 20th to get everything passed could be politically tricky, as votes on spending bills may coincide with votes on articles of impeachment against President Trump. About 30,000 laid-off workers will lose a tax credit that helps them buy health insurance at the end of the year unless it is included in stalled tax legislation. The health coverage tax credit pays 72.5% of the cost of health insurance premiums for workers who receive trade adjustment assistance or benefits from the Pension Benefits Guarantee Corporation. The IRS pays the credit directly to insurers in many cases. Legislation has been introduced that would extend the credit, and there is an attempt to attach such legislation to a tax extenders package that is being negotiated by the House and Senate. Legislation aimed at lowering prescription drug prices is likely to undergo some changes, namely seeking to reduce consumers' out-of-pocket costs, benefiting seniors and people with disabilities. There's hope the changes would earn enough support to pass the bill before the end of this year. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist mom Diane Lim. We will be discussing generational perspectives and the role of economists in policymaking. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist mom, Diane Lim. Bob, you know very well, he's a regular contributor and actually substitute host on the show. Diane is also a regular contributor. You know her well as the economist mom in her past segments with us. She's also working with the Penn Wharton budget model. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Diane.
Thanks, Chase.
And congratulations on becoming a new dad.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's certainly a lifestyle change. It's our first child, and you know he's very demanding when it comes to his schedule.
Well, and I assume that you're starting to get a glimmer of why I have all these years cared so much about fiscal sustainability as a mom rather than as an economist.
Absolutely. The moment that my son entered the world, my perspective personally changed a whole lot. I started to care about things in a different way, and I realized how little I cared about anything else. So absolutely, with this new vantage point of having to care for a young one and help raise up the next generation of leaders, I have at least a reinforced view, especially on the issues of fiscal policy and, I guess, generational equity.
Right. Good.
Well, I just want to say I appreciate your contributing another worker into the workforce to support me in my retirement. So that's...
Oh, you're welcome, Bob. That was really the motivation for having a child, to help correct the Social Security ratio.
Yeah, well, good.
No, we're very excited. My wife and I love him very, very much, obviously, and are very, very sleep deprived. I think I've been averaging 1 to 3 hours of sleep a night. We've yet to master the art of a routine or a schedule yet, mostly because he just decides, you know, on a given day that he's going to throw his routine out the window and do something totally different.
Well, Chase, you know, there's when we were doing the fiscal wake-up tour, Joe Minerick, a sometime guest on this program and former colleague of Diane's, used to show a picture of his granddaughter when she was quite young, and this was the end of his presentation, and he would say about the debt and the deficit, this is not her fault, but it is her problem.
Right.
And it was a really good way of sort of looking at it from the standpoint of somebody who's not able to look out for themselves, and we have to look out for them. And you, you see that this is something that younger people are going to have to deal with one way or the other. We can help by changing policies now, but it really is their future.
I think that makes an incredibly important point, and that ties into things we've been discussing on the show the last couple of weeks with millennials and their perspective on these issues. And I'm a millennial. My son certainly won't be. But to Minerick's point, you know, I think that my generation is going to have to deal with this a fair amount, but it's really going to fall on my son Ryan's generation and their shoulders, because we may be feeling, I think, the soft effects, but I think if we don't get our act together, they're going to feel some very serious consequences, and tough choices are going to be sort of thrust upon them. And you're right. We need to be doing a better job of looking out for those who can't really look out for themselves yet.
Yeah, because it's really the choices that we make today that can help smooth the way by building a stronger economy. Because, you know, the whole point about fiscal responsibility really is not just being responsible, but it's building a stronger economy. I think that's a point that maybe sometimes gets overlooked in the day-to-day grind and fights over specific spending and tax programs. The whole reason that the Concord Coalition came into being was not so much to be a overall accountant of the books, but to think about ways in which we could make for a strong economy in the future. And running persistently large and ever-growing budget deficits is not a good way to build a strong economy for the future. And so hence the focus on fiscal responsibility. But the whole purpose is to have a strong, growing economy so people like your son will have a better world and more opportunities than you have or that I have.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we talk about fiscal responsibility, we often use the phrase, you know, we should be good stewards for future generations. But, you know, I think that it's not just being good stewards about the federal budget, but it's being good stewards about the economy, what we're doing with the economy more broadly. So I think sometimes those of us who care about fiscal sustainability get misinterpreted as only caring about the accounting identities and the balance of federal government's book. But I think that the reason why we have to care running unsustainable deficits is that it just means that it becomes all the more important that the economy is strong so that our kids can actually support that burden, that higher burden in the future. So it's often used as an argument for why we shouldn't worry about it. Oh, the economy always grows. Oh, future generations are always better off economically. But we have been seeing a lot of evidence lately that economic growth is not as strong as it used to be, and that we're maybe not making really great public investments that will ensure that future generations will have the capacity to pay off the bills.
Yeah, I think now more than ever, I'm thinking about these issues And, you know, my life and the choices I make is sort of in framing it in legacy. You know, what am I handing off to my children? Because, you know, we would like to have more than one child. But right now it's just Ryan. So what are we handing off to him? And I that's a very, very broad question in my mind, because I am hopeful, like you said, that we can make those higher level decisions that can set him up for a really bright future. And I'm hoping that I can make the same personal decisions that can set him up for a really bright future. And I think a lot of those decisions come hand in hand, because we, you know, all politics is local, and we often compare federal budget policy to, you know, a business budget or a, you know, a home budget, and having to make some of those difficult decisions and what happens long term if you don't, or what happens if you get a little too over leveraged in debt. And so all those things are swirling around in my mind, and much to much like what Bob has said in the past, where I'm now facing my future, this is all incredibly tangible for me right now. And I think it's an important lesson that really drives all of this home, in how important it is to make issues like this tangible for others, to help them understand that we really do have to grapple with quite a bit. And just putting our head in the sand and walking away and saying some other generation can handle it is eventually, we're not going to be able to make that excuse for much longer.
Very good. Yes, that was very well said, Chase, for someone who's so sleep deprived.
I really appreciate that. I struggled a little bit going through that, but I mean it. And that's probably why I was able to say it so emphatically, is it is something I'm incredibly passionate about right now. And sort of piggybacking off of this conversation, Dan, one of the questions I had for you, since you're the economist mom and your kids are much older now, mine is only a month old, how did your perspective change, or did it change, as your children grew up and you started making those personal decisions and you started looking out to the future on those, you know, much larger scale decisions as an economist?
Well, I mean, it becomes more real as your children grow up, and it actually becomes more real, more of a concern, because as your children grow up and they head out, you know, they go to college, they head out into the workforce, you become more aware of their job opportunities, their economic future, and they become aware, they start asking you questions about the taxes that are being withheld from their paychecks, and, you know, what's that for? You know, my daughter, her first paycheck, she asked me, what's this FICA stuff that's being taken out of my paycheck? And so it makes it more real, because you have these conversations with your kids about, you know, the line items in their pay stub and how that is means they're participating in these government programs. You start to worry even more keenly about the state of those programs. And, you know, the kids talk about how, you know, they're not going to be able to have any Social Security when they're, you know, when they retire. And so the intergenerational burden, that shift of the burden and the threat of it actually materializing in terms of lower economic well-being for my children, it just becomes a lot more real as they actually become real workers in the workforce. So, and at the same time, it has, when your children become adults, you can have conversations with them, and they're good conversations, and I often wish that there would be more of these intergenerational conversations in the policymaking world, you know, rather than just around the Thanksgiving dinner table.
That's a timely remark, since Thanksgiving's in a couple days. Nice. A follow-up then, Diane. Has there been sort of a mantle passing to your children? Like, you have focused on these issues, you functioned as an economist for decades, and your children, I'm assuming, have grown up in that environment. And we talked last week, and maybe even the week before, on how basically millennials don't care about debt and deficit issues, at least not as much as other issues like climate change. Is that the case for your own children?
Yeah.
You know, did they, growing up in that environment, did they walk away or walk into the world with a pretty high level of interest on these issues and passion for them, or have they kind of gone a different route with the generation that they're in?
I would say that relative to other kids their age, they grew up with a keener understanding and awareness of the fiscal issues, just because it was, you know, I was always talking about them, not so much at home, but they just were following what I did for my job, and so they were just more aware that way. But yeah, even with my own kids, they're definitely more concerned about environmental issues than any other public policy issue, I would say, because it's such an obvious, you know, it's a very tangible, obvious issue that affects everyone. It's a lot more real to my children because they are all very outdoors people. They value the environment very much. They all think that people waste are too wasteful in terms of our energy consumption, that we just have too large a carbon footprint, all of us. So I just think it's just more real for younger people in terms of it. They can see it in their daily lives, the irresponsibility. Like, you can't see, real people can't see on a daily basis fiscal irresponsibility. They can see in a very tangible, visible way, everyday environmental irresponsibility. So I just think, you know, the fiscal policy issues, they're definitely not attention grabbers out there. And the fact that who are the people talking about it most? They're economists. And economists aren't, you know, they're not known, we're not known as being real world relevant people. Like, it's sort of like we talk in another language. We put out numbers that don't translate to tangible concepts to ordinary people who aren't economists. I think that part of the reason why fiscal responsibility has not been a prominent issue in the minds of the public is because the messengers of the issue are not good communicators with the general public.
Oh, I resent that, Diane. No, I'm just kidding. I agree with you. I think it can be an incredibly dry set of issues, you know, and the flashy stuff.
Yeah, dry and abstract.
Dry and abstract, yeah. and the stuff that does make the news, it's, you know, it falls in, I'm going to say this, and it's going to sound bad, but it's sort of, I'm thinking globally here in terms of the total budget, but it's sort of small potatoes, the things that jump out in the news, like some kind of, you know, welfare fraud or Medicaid fraud or you know,
yeah.
some,
mm-hmm.
you know, pharmaceutical company that's charging too much for a particular drug, in terms of how these things impact fiscal policy. And it's hard to draw a straight line from those issues to, say, the annual deficit, and thus you lose people along the way. And, you know, to your point on climate change, it's very easy to draw a straight line to, say, sea level rising and our carbon footprint. It's just it's an easier, more, I guess, logical connection in most people's minds when they are seeing it manifest in their lives. And I think that's part of the struggle.
Right.
When you've got a dry economist standing in front of a room of people and trying to keep them awake.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I think it may be an element of crisis fatigue also with deficit and debt. I mean, you go back to, say, 1992, that presidential campaign, but maybe even back into the 80s a little bit, when we really for the first time had high deficits in a peacetime growing economy. That was very alarming to people, and so the deficit became a big issue in 92 and became very much an issue in 96 and even in the 2000 race, you might recall the competition between Bush and Gore over what to do with the surplus. But it was a very fiscal-oriented debate. And, you know, I think in some ways we were victims of our own success, and the fact that during the 90s there was a concerted bipartisan effort to reduce the deficit. We did have 4 years of budget surpluses and even paid down a little bit of the debt. And I think there was a sense of, well, you know, this issue, this disease has been cured. And, you know, that obviously the deficit came back and bigger and more, you know, ingrained than ever and has been rising ever since. But there's been a sense, I think, among people. I get this question all the time about, well, you people have been talking about deficits or warning about this for 30 years, and, you know, nothing's happened yet. Well, my two responses to that. One, about the first 10 years of those, something did happen. We paid down, we balanced the budget. And so it's not like nobody did anything. There was a very positive bipartisan reaction. And in the interim, as we have ignored the deficit and debt and let it grow. And there were good reasons to do it in some cases. I mean, you know, you had to respond to 9/11, the breaking budget caps and that sort of thing, during the Great Recession that happened in 2008 to 2009. You know, you had to respond to that. So it's not as if, you know, we should have been paying down the debt during those times. But the long-term things we warned about back in the 90s are now in effect. The baby boom generation is old and getting older and is retiring. That's having an effect on the budget. It's having an effect on the economy. Diane mentioned before the signs that, you know, the economy is slower on a permanent basis. In other words, the new normal is for a slower economy. That has to do in large part with demographic changes that we were warning about years ago. But it doesn't have, so the some of the things that we warned about, like a slower growing economy and a budget way out of whack, that is happening. And but we've just sort of reached a point where we decided, now that it's here, we're not going to react to it.
Well, and can I interject there? Because, like, not to disparage my own profession and what we care about even more, but I would make the point, like, when you look at economic crises, they do come and go. They do come and go. They are not typically irreversible, right? And the economy works in a way that there is a natural correction that's built into the economy. Like when deficits get to be too large for investors to have confidence in investing in government bonds, interest rates will get so high. They have to eventually get so high that the government is forced to be more disciplined. It's very different from environmental crises that are in large part irreversible, right? So there is, and I think everyone understands this, that there's a difference between an economic crisis and environmental crisis. So I would not say that economic crises rise to the level of concern that environmental crisis does. And that's why I would never suggest, oh, we should definitely pay more attention to the budget deficit than global warming. But at the same time, I think there are solutions to the environmental problem that are consistent with reducing problems in the fiscal policy.
Yeah,
world.
I think you can do both. You know, why can't we walk and chew gum at the same time? We don't have to be so focused on just one issue when most people would acknowledge that there are dozens of issues that should all be on the table and we're working towards solutions on them. And
right.
I think we should have a broader outlook on what we're tackling and how we're tackling and have more of a solutions-oriented focus. And Bob, you made a great point about, you know, there probably is quite a bit of crisis fatigue, especially on this issue. If you're someone who's been involved with the issue over the last 2 to 3 decades, or someone who's been paying attention or understands, you know, or at least were aware during the 90s and early 2000s, my generation, I don't think, has really had that advantage. I would say with us, perhaps it's not crisis fatigue. I think with my generation, there's a bit of callousness there because we've grown up in a generation that's experienced the Great Recession and growing budget deficits, a growing federal debt, a lot of personal debt like education debt and credit cards and vehicles. We're swimming in debt in almost every corner of my generation. And I think there's this mindset setting in of, well, it's not that big of a deal. We seem to be making things get by, and the economy is not great, but it's humming along, and I'm able to find a job after college, and big whoop. But I think we're at a reset point where everything that policy analysts or nonprofits like the Conquer Coalition were warning about, looking from the 90s forward, we're in it now and looking forward saying it's not going to get any better. So I think that fatigue for past generations, callousness for ours. And then again, Diane, you also made a great point about how economic impacts, recessions, they come and go. You know, there are other issues where it's sort of a permanent issue that just sort of lasts. So
yeah.
if it comes and goes, then it's sort of in and out of your brain, out of sight, out of mind. And I think for us, it's been a little bit out of sight, out of mind, and that's probably going to have to change. But this is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, Economist Mom, Diane Lim. We haven't been discussing the topic of the day, which was going to be how economists estimate the impact of big policy changes or ideas and how they deal with politics. I kind of want to get to that topic still a little bit, and I guess a good segue, Diane, might be when you were talking a bit about the role of the economist in this big picture, you know, fiscal policy as a whole, and the way they pitch things and analyze things. So let's start there. What do you see as the role of the economist, especially in this very divided political partisan environment?
Well, okay, so the role of economists in public policy development and analysis has always been to attach numbers to the ideas, to talk about how much things will cost or how much revenue it would raise, what would the effects be on the big economic, the kind of macroeconomic factors such as labor supply, savings in the capital stock, and GDP. So occasionally, economists will provide what we call distributional analysis, which goes beyond saying how much revenue a tax proposal would raise, but who would bear the burden, how the burden would be distributed across different income categories of households, for example. But the typical output of an economist is more numbers than words. And when we attach words to the, put words around the numbers, it's often telling a story about the aggregate macro economy. It is not, we don't do a very good job about talking about the stories about how these policies would affect individual households or businesses.
Especially when you have to use terms like aggregate macro economy.
Right. So you know, the ultimate measure of how good or bad a policy is from an economist standpoint is typically, you know, the total output of the economy, GDP, which to an ordinary person, that doesn't mean anything, right? And similarly, when we even talk about deficits, we talk about deficits, the gap between spending and revenues as a share of GDP. And, you know, we say this is concerning. It's at a high point. It's never been this high in a time of peace or a non-recessionary period. And, you know, all those words I just said, everyone would say, so what? You know, so and economists in large part are only talking to themselves. Like, it's like, oh, let's compare this organization's revenue estimate to that organization's revenue estimate, or what's different about the modeling of
dynamic and static.
And so the role of the economist has traditionally been, and by the way, we're taught this in graduate school, that we only provide the objective analyses, and we can't put value judgments as to whether a policy is good or bad, or whether the government should do this policy. We just lay out all the facts, and we let the policymakers, the politicians, the people to make choices about policies, make decisions about the trade-offs they're willing to make. I would argue that economists have not been great at helping politicians figure this out, like even quantify the trade-off. So we often just have a fully baked policy that an economic shop would have to analyze, would have to score in terms of the cost or the revenues gain, we'd have to analyze in terms of the effect on the macro economy. But we're often not told to show in our output any more than the effects of the fully baked proposal. We're not often asked to kind of vary the policy specification. For example, what if we instead of this proposal to raise the marginal tax rate to this amount, what if we instead raised it by a lower amount? Or what if we broadened the tax base instead of, you know, what if we included more income in what is taxed rather than raising the rate at which we're taxing it? So we are not typically asked at the point at which politicians are voting for proposals. They are not given like a menu of options. They are just told, take this or leave it. You either vote for this proposal or you don't. You have the score from the Joint Committee on Taxation or from the Congressional Budget Office. That's all the information. You might have a dynamic analysis that tells you something about the effects on the macroeconomy. So take this information, and based on that, the expert analysis of the economist, you decide whether you like the proposal enough to vote for it, up or down. And so I think in a lot of ways that that prevents economists from being as helpful as they could be in the policymaking process, because A, we haven't really provided any information about how this affects a typical household, you know, or a typical business or particular types of households or businesses. And B, we haven't told the policymakers what trade-offs have already been made in the process of writing legislation to choose a particular policy specification. And I view that as unfortunate, because it makes economists, even though we're not the ones that want to decide the trade-offs to make, we still should be able to provide the information that helps the politicians, the policymakers, understand the trade-offs that they can make in making a choice for one form of a policy or another.
Is that the fault of the economists or the politicians? And, I mean, most of the politicians that write big bills, like major legislation or something, it seems to me they want a score that justifies what they want to do, and they hamstring CBO sometimes by saying, you know, here's a set of facts. Assume these things and only tell me this, rather than they don't really want, it seems to me, CBO to give them a range.
Oh, you mean in terms of their final
cost?
Yeah, so CBO and Joint Committee on Taxation, when they score proposals, they're only going to come up with a point estimate. They're going to come up with that point estimate, specific numbers for the cost or the gain from a proposal. They're only going to be basing it on the actual legislation that they're supposed to be scoring. So they're not given a menu of different possible policy options to score. It's not to say, though, that the policymakers, actually the members of Congress, have the right to work with CBO or Joint Committee on Taxation before a bill is fully introduced.
And they frequently do to try to
CBO,
figure out how CBO would score
something. Ideally early in policy formulation process, like maybe years before a politician wants to introduce a piece of legislation that's a tax reform bill or a spending bill, he or she would approach CBO and see if CBO might be able to do what CBO considers a longer-term study on the issue. So, you know, in the 90s, when I was at CBO, we did a study on the economic effects of fundamental tax reform, where we were able to consider alternative policies to, you know, both broaden the base and switch more toward a consumption-based tax. They always have that resource available to them. CBO and all the government economists, they can't handle every request. But to be quite honest, I don't think there's a lot of policymakers that reach out to the analysts for that far ahead of time, because their time horizons are very short. And when they decide they want to introduce a piece of legislation that's a tax reform bill or a spending bill, they want to do it quickly. And they do have staff that are policy experts, that are policy staff that are supposed to help them write legislation. They don't typically have economists on staff, but it usually happens very quickly. Like it doesn't take that long to write a piece of legislation if you don't care about waiting for an analysis about the economic effects of the legislation. So frankly,
that tends to be the case.
Frankly, I just think it's time constraint. Like, nobody would want to take that much time to try to get an analysis from any economist on government staff to understand the trade-off.
Does the average economist care that their analysis is sort of lost in the haze of, you know, the policy or the rhetoric surrounding an issue? I mean, we talked a bit about the message versus the messenger earlier in the show. Do we need to adapt the messenger? Do we need to get a little more jazzy and exciting and a little more in the moment with how, you know, economists are delivering their analysis? Or are they pretty content with, this is what I do, this is my role, and everyone else can worry about how to get it out there?
I think it, government economists are limited in what they can spend their time doing in terms of they are responding to requests from Congress or the administration. I think it's different for policy economists that are in the nonprofit and academic world. I think that, those of us who are working outside of government where we have to respond to certain requests on a very timely basis and we don't have time to do longer-term analyses, I think that those of us outside of that world, the government world, actually do want to provide the kind of analysis that will inform policy, even though we're not working for government. And the way that we hope it will inform policy is that we have the luxury of being able to do more work in terms of highlighting trade-offs in policymaking and policy levers, I call them, and talking about how different policies, for example, tax policy, there's often a trade-off between policies that are geared solely to increase GDP growth the most versus policies that would decrease economic inequality. There's usually, those are probably different policies. It's obvious to people that if we talk about, you know, a wealth tax that would be great at hitting the very richest households. I think it's pretty obvious to people that the trade-off in that is that there's a lot of economic activity that happens because of billionaires. And so that it's very difficult to both say you're going to kind of try to knock down the wealth of mostly billionaires, and it's difficult to say that that would be good for the economy in terms of GDP, aggregate GDP growth. And because economists, models typically characterize the trade-off between growth and efficiency and equity according to GDP effects versus distributional effects on, you know, lower and middle class households. I don't think we help spell out the trade-off in terms of how it affects people at a household level. And so I think that we would like to help policymakers understand that there are different goals of tax policy or spending policy, different economic goals, and that your choice of who to tax, how intensely to tax them, what to do with the revenue that you raise from a tax, in terms of are you going to use it to reduce the deficit, are you going to use it to pay for a government spending program, they make huge differences as to how the total policy package, the piece of legislation, is going to affect households at an individual level and different types of households differently. So, you know, kind of my current mission is like, my gosh, you know, I'm working with Penn Wharton Budget Model now, and I'm really hoping that we can start to do a little bit better in terms of highlighting trade-offs in policymaking because we have the luxury of being able to run alternative scenarios and to be able to do estimates of different policies that are not fully baked, that are not already introduced as pieces of legislation, and to explain why certain policies have certain aggregate macroeconomic effects but also have certain distributional effects, and how those economic effects will differ depending on what you do with the revenue.
And I had a whole variety of additional questions, but we are unfortunately completely out of time. We spent too much time, I think, talking about our children, but it ended up being a really productive conversation. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and I apologize, Bob, for cutting you off just then. We've also been chatting with economist mom, Diane Lim. We've discussed parenthood, generational perspectives, and the role of economists in this crazy world. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
You're welcome, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. It's football season, so why not acknowledge that at times it's better just to punt? Well, Congress did just that again for the second time in the fiscal year 2020 budget process. It was fourth and long. Very long. The chances of passing appropriations bills to fund government agencies for the current fiscal year, which actually began back on October 1st, were slim. So Congress did what they had done many times in the past. They punted. The Senate approved a bill previously approved by the House that would extend funding at last year's levels from November 21st to December 20th. The president signed the bill, avoiding for now a government shutdown. In July, there were actually hopes that appropriations bills could be passed without a shutdown crisis when the House and Senate agreed to raise existing spending caps for overall fiscal year 2020 appropriations by over $170 billion. The extra money, it was thought, would grease the skids for deals on the 12 individual appropriations bills. Well, as you can see, that hasn't happened. House and Senate appropriators have failed over more than 3 months since the July agreement to agree on how to allocate funding among the 12 annual bills. It is not surprising that the two parties have different priorities and that those priorities are reflected in their respective allocation levels. It is surprising, however, that compromise on such a basic issue has not been reached despite action-inducing deadlines. It's hard to be optimistic about what comes next. Not only have appropriators failed to agree on funding levels for the 12 individual bills, they've also failed to resolve a disagreement with the president over funding for a southern border wall, the issue that precipitated a partial government shutdown earlier this year. In fact, it was the longest in our nation's history. Moreover, the new deadline of December 20th falls during a time when the House could be considering a vote on whether to impeach the president. How that vote will affect negotiations over funding levels and the border wall is anybody's guess. From a strictly fiscal point of view, keeping appropriations at 2019 levels prevents the agreed-upon cap increase from taking effect. In fact, the 2019 funding level is actually higher than the 2020 level was supposed to be if the caps had been kept in place. Still, operating under a series of temporary, quote, continuing resolutions is a terrible way to run the government. It hobbles agency planning, encourages arbitrary decision-making, and highlights political dysfunction. They executed the punt, but the situation has not changed. It's still fourth and long. And that gets us to another important point that I've made several times before on the show. In coping with the nation's seemingly broken appropriations process, budget process changes or trigger mechanisms cannot substitute for political will. There's no shortage of proposals in Congress and even in academia for improving the federal budget process. Given that the process has remained essentially unchanged since 1974, it may well be overdue for a facelift. Many of the proposals, such as biennial budgeting, could refocus lawmakers' attention on long-term thinking. Others would create long-term fiscal targets and automatic mechanisms to enforce them. Such reforms could represent a positive step for the federal budget process, but ultimately, they cannot substitute for political will to make difficult decisions. A prime example of this reality is pay-as-you-go or pay-go rules adopted by Congress in various forms over the past 30 years. They require that any legislation that lowers revenues or expands mandatory spending be offset with revenue increases or mandatory spending cuts. Violations are supposed to be enforced through automatic cuts in other programs. While PAYGO is an important standard that should be adhered to, in practice, this component of the budget process has regularly been waived for major deficit-increasing legislation. Other times, procedural mechanisms to enforce fiscal discipline take the form of legislative triggers, included in individual pieces of legislation rather than as a permanent fixture of the budget process. But at the end of the day, Congress is Congress. It makes the rules, it can change the rules, and it can avoid the rules. There needs to be political will to stick to those rules or to engage in reform and then, of course, abide by those reforms. It's time for policymakers to stop punting. Don't get me wrong. My earlier point that sometimes you have to punt still holds true, but maybe, just maybe, go for it once or twice on fourth down. Perhaps it will lead to a big play or result in a game-winning drive. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.